God manifested in the cherubim. The subject of God manifestation in conjunction with the cherubim is a glorious subject indeed. The cherubim speaks to us of divine glory and is a huge and comprehensive study. If we were able to give a dozen addresses on this subject, I'm sure we would still have only scratched at the surface, and so today's exposition will be limited to the work and general character of the cherubim. When Adam was in the garden, there was no religion, and hence there was no cherubim. The cherubim would not be in existence if religion wasn't needed. The cherubim is centered around God's plan of salvation. It was when man was cast forth from the garden that the principles of religion were founded. The cherubim placed at the door of the garden illustrated the plan of salvation. Why didn't Yahweh build a high wall around the garden? Why did Yahweh not place an angel there to protect the way of life? Why not a wall of fire? The cherubim were created because new circumstances, new conditions arose. Conditions which involve man being in a state of enmity with God. A state which involved there being no fellowship between God and man. An illustration, we say, is better than 1,000 words. When Christ gave the Sermon on the Mount, he provided the basis for everything he was going to say for 3.5 years to follow. The groundwork upon which everything he was going to say was to be built. The cherubim was similar in that it spoke volumes of truth. It laid the very foundation that the whole work of God manifestation was to be built on, right from the start in Genesis through to the 22nd chapter of the book of the Apocalypse. Adam, after transgression, was sent forth from the area that provided life. He was expelled. Man was without hope. He was destitute. Adam had no hope. He was indeed expelled from the garden. The plan was expressed to him as he was sent forth. Mankind today would be without hope, brethren and sisters, apart from divine revelation. Man would face eternal death because of transgression. Let us bear this in mind as we take a step forward and see the cherubim and the flaming sword burst in on the scene. Its purpose is to preserve the way, to keep the tree, and to profoundly show forth God's mercy. We will all remember very plainly the words of David that were repeated time and time again. Thy mercy endureth forever. Adam could look back to the cherubim and be reminded of the mercy of the Almighty, showing that despite his own transgression, that one act of gross wickedness on Adam's part, Yahweh still intended to preserve the way. Anyone who saw the object would have beheld the divine plan, and it was there for the first 1,656 years of the life of man until the flood, when God intended for a specific era to come to an end. Throughout these early years, man did not build an altar. No, not one. For the cherubim of glory showed that man would only be accepted through the shedding of blood. Yahweh appointed the altar of the cherubim as the one place that he dedicated for this purpose. And man was shown that no other way was possible. All other ways were Cain worship. After the flood, we are informed that Noah was commanded to build an altar and offer burnt sacrifices upon it. And what comes out time and time again is that the cherubim were guardians of divine truth, and this is its primary and principal purpose. There was no cherubim for a period after the flood, for other guardians were appointed. Noah and his family became the cherubim. Yahweh has never left himself without witness. His truth has always been and will always be guarded. It will always be preserved. The way of life will always be preserved. After 1656, deity was no longer manifested in the cherubim at the door of the garden. Instead, deity was manifested through the life and the work of Noah and his family. From Genesis to the end of the millennium, the cherubim, in one aspect or another, always has been and always will be in operation. Religion will be needed, salvation will be required, until the final plan of redemption, until the need for remission of sin comes to a finality, and for as long as religion is needed, the cherubim will be there to guard the truth and to preserve the way until religion is needed no more, when death shall be abolished at the end of the millennium. At the time when the divisions occurred in the Christadelphian body in the late 1800s, Brother Roberts wrote that it is necessary to guard the truth against all error. He said, "Though all vote for union, I will stand aside and reject it on my own." That's the principle we must always adopt in preserving the truth in all kinds of circumstances. This we must do without compromise and without ever diluting the principles of the truth. It is our responsibility and something for which we will be held accountable. Genesis 3, verse 24. Genesis 3, verse 24. So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim, and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. At this point, the cherubim became a lightstand in the earth, and it will remain a lightstand throughout the 7,000-year plan. Divine acceptance was proclaimed, and God's character was revealed in a multitude of truth keepers or truth guardians. These characteristics of preservation and defense are the characteristics of the Christ body. They are the manifestation of the glory of the Christ body. The principles reveal, they indeed introduce our minds to the gate, the way, and the tree. Christ said during his first reign on earth, did he not? "I am the way," he said. "I am the gate, and I am the life or light." The form of the Genesis cherubim are not described, only their work and their character. Why is this? Well, there's been many suggestions that the Pentateuch was written probably during the period 1459 to 1410, and the Pentateuch was all one book. There was no need to describe in Genesis when the subject is described in detail elsewhere and as soon as the book of Exodus. Although different symbols are used in different parts of the scriptures that deal with the cherubim, the same message is conveyed throughout. The thing about the cherubim is this: it is hidden. The cherubim is hidden. What does it mean? It gives us a tremendous vision. It reveals so much. The tabernacle, brethren and sisters, is a classic case in point. Around the tabernacle, there was a 10-foot linen cloth. Men could not see through it. A wooden gate was lifted up for men to pass through it to get into the way of life. And Genesis, therefore, demonstrates the glory and office of the cherubim. We have to wait until we come to Exodus to the actual building of the tabernacle before we can actually see, if you like, the work of the cherubim. But even in Exodus, its parts did not mean anything. The elements scattered abroad, as it were, each one with its cloth, its gold, the wood, and so on and so forth. Each one doing its part with no divine manifestation, with no divine meaning in their singular form. But suddenly, the tabernacle is complete. We find it assembled And immediately the cherubic glory filled it. In Genesis 3 and verse 24, where we read, "So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword." Brother Thomas refers to the word "and" there as the word "Eden." And therefore, in the translated text, it should read, "So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim, even a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way to the tree of life." Let us make this point clear then, that the flaming sword were not the cherubim, but the cherubim's work was a flaming sword. In Hebrews chapter 4, brethren and sisters, there is a description of this. Come with me to the book of Hebrews in chapter 4. Verse 12. This is the work of the cherubim. Chapter 4, verse 12. "For the word of God is quick and powerful, and it's sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit, and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Neither is there any creature that is not manifested in his sight. But all things are naked and opened unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Here in Hebrews, we have this wielding sword of judgment as an acceptor or rejecter of men. This is also illustrated in Genesis chapter 4, verse 7, if we can turn there, with the divine rejection of Cain and acceptance of Abel. God says, "If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door." All we are given to understand about the events that took place between Cain and Abel illustrate to us of Abel. He was knowing. He was appreciating and accepting of the works of salvation in regards to the revelation given to him at the cherubim door. He knew what to offer, which was no doubt a goat. He submitted to divine rules. We are liable to forget that it is according to divine rules that we receive the salvation of the truth. The truth either rules us or we rule the truth. We can worship God to our own conscience. That is Cain worship. That is exactly the way that Cain reasoned on this occasion. The interesting thing is, brethren and sisters, what was the result? Cain was a religionist after a willful stamp, Brother Thomas's words. He was a gardener, a lovely occupation, but in this symbol it portrays someone who is a lover of the ground, a naturalist, if you like. Abel, in contrast, was a shepherd, a lover of the sheep. There was nothing wrong with Cain going to Abel and buying himself a sacrifice. King David says, "I will not give unto Yahweh that which cost me nothing." So the way was open for him to do right. But the point is, he refused to do what was right. What did Cain see at the altar? Not much. He saw blood, animals, and a smell, all of which were unpleasant. That's what he saw and experienced. If we do away with the shedding of blood like the Roman Catholics, then there's nothing left. There's no point. This is the point in the whole incident. There was no point in Cain offering because he didn't believe. He failed to appreciate. He failed to acknowledge. And he failed to understand the plan of salvation, the work and the very operation of the divine cherubim. One other thing is clear. Cain was a worshipper. He probably spent, and let us not underestimate, the amount of time he spent preparing the best of the fruit and presented at the cherubim his harvest thanksgiving. A beautiful array of fruit and things of the ground was presented, no doubt, with a delicious aroma. Verse 3 of this chapter says, he brought his offering. He was a worshipper. So no wonder it says in verse 5 that he was very angry, that Yahweh rejected his offering and accepted Abel's. The whole significance, brethren and sisters, was lost on Cain. In verse 7, if thou doest well, in accordance with the revelation, God says, shalt thou not be accepted? Here, for the first time, revealed in the cherubic altar, is the marvelous fact that Yahweh accepts man who fails through weakness. If thou doest not well, on the other hand, if thou doest not well, a sacrifice lieth at the door of the cherubim. If our heart condemns us not, then we are at peace with God. If our heart condemns us, then God is greater than our hearts and knoweth all things when true repentance is offered. Man is like Cain through and through. That is the nature we bear. The one talent man goes to great lengths to do what Yahweh didn't ask him to do. Everything that is not commanded, the Roman Catholics do. They won't do anything that is commanded. This whole incident provides us with that day of judgment that Brother Philip mentioned in his prayer. And so Abel offered his sacrifice. And the fire, the glory of divine manifestation, bursts forth in on the scene and consumes the offering. There is no record that Abel took wood or fire. When Cain comes along to offer his harvest, there were thick clouds and darkness hiding divine glory, a refusal to respond as later revelations show it to be. There is a grand illustration of this in the 14th chapter of Exodus, verse 19, in the separation of Israel from the Egyptians. The pillar of cloud went before their face. It came between the camp of Israel and the Egyptians. And what did the Egyptians see? They saw darkness and cloud and tempest, as it were. A darkness that could be felt, but it gave light all night to the Israelites. And so in this illustration, we have darkness to the world and light to those who preserve the truth, preserve the way. And this is what we have in the symbol of the cherubim. Genesis 4, verse 13. And Cain said unto the Lord, unto Yahweh, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid. And I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth, and it shall come to pass that everyone that findeth me shall slay me. From thy faces I shall be hid. We have here an illustration of how deity manifests himself in acceptance and rejection. These illustrations show us that those accepted by the work of the cherubim manifest the same characteristics, a point we'll elaborate on a little later. We would like to speak now on the aspect of the fire and the cloud. The fire illustrates acceptance. Let us think of the sacrifices being consumed by Yahweh when the offering was accepted. The cloud illustrates rejection. The tabernacle was dead and useless during the process of construction, and even at first when assembled. A person is dead and useless without life. When the tabernacle was completed, suddenly the cherubic glory appeared. All the elements of the tabernacle could be seen in the making of it. But they did not have meaning. They did not have purpose until the glory of Yahweh bursts in on the scene. The same idea, brethren and sisters, is expressed in the 80th Psalm. Psalm 80, verse 1. verse 1. Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, thou that leadest Joseph like a flock, thou that dwellest between the cherubim, shine forth, verse 3. Turn us again, O God, and cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved, verse 7. Turn us again, O God of hosts, and cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved, verse 19. Turn us again, O Yahweh Elohim of armies, cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved. Without shining forth, without God manifesting his glory, all was deadness, all was silent. When it shone and burst forth in glory, then we see the divine acceptance manifested. We turn briefly to Christ, moving among the Israelites, the hidden glory of Yahweh only seen by a few. In Jesus' life, and especially in his death, we see this cherubic glory blazing forth, not only in acceptance, but in divine rejection. I don't want to spend a great deal of time on this, but if you come with me to Matthew 27 and verse 45, here we have a picture painted for us. Matthew 27 and verse 45. This picture of darkness, of tempest and judgment. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land unto the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? That is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them that stood there when they heard that said, this man calleth for Elias. And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with a vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. The rest said, let be, let us see whether Elias will come to save him. Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the spirit and beheld. And behold, rather, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. And the earth did quake, and the rocks rent, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose. Darkness, tempest, and judgment. Divine revelation and the manifestation of divine intervention and glory. Now, one meaning of the word cherubim is the held fast ones, those holding fast. Brother Thomas defines it this way. So we get the overall idea of the truth being preserved in and through those holding fast. To really drive home an illustration of this point, let us turn to 1 Chronicles 21, verse 9. 9. Here we have the account of the numbering of Israel. And Yahweh spake unto Gad, David's seer, saying, go and tell David, saying, thus saith Yahweh, I offer thee three things. Choose thee one of them, that I may do it unto thee. This is talking about judgment. So Gad came to David and said unto him, thus saith Yahweh, choose thee either 3 years famine, or 3 months to be destroyed before thy foes, while that the sword of thine enemies overtaketh thee, or else 3 days, the sword of Yahweh, even the pestilence in the land, and the angel of Yahweh destroying throughout all the coasts of Israel. Now therefore advise thyself what word I shall bring again to him that sent me. And David said unto Gad, I am in a great strait. Let me fall now into the hand of Yahweh, for very great are his mercies, but let me not fall into the hand of man. So Yahweh sent pestilence upon Israel, and there fell of Israel 70,000 men. And God sent an angel unto Jerusalem to destroy it. And as he was destroying, Yahweh beheld, and he repented him of the evil, and said to the angel that destroyed, it is enough, stay now thine hand. And the angel of Yahweh stood by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of Yahweh stand between the earth and the heaven, having a drawn sword in his hand, stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders of Israel, who were clothed in sackcloth, fell upon their faces. Here David is asked to choose from three judgments. The sword is one choice, and this takes us right back to the book of Genesis, where God manifestation is revealed through the operation of the cherubim work, first in rejection and then in acceptance. Let us look at verse 16. Again, David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of Yahweh stand between the earth and the heaven, having a drawn sword in his hand. If the sword with the pestilence was all over the land, why did David see an angel with a drawn sword in his hand? It was, brethren and sisters, to show that the judgment was spreading. And so in verse 18, David is commanded to build an altar. Certainly David had to build it and prepare the offerings to be laid upon it. But here no fire was needed. Yahweh was the fire. It came from heaven and consumed David's offering. This is tremendous. It's full of significance. In David's trials, at a time when David had been failing, we see the glorious and divine manifestation of forgiveness. Only David knew it. Failing or no failing, it is only truth holders that have the secret of the salvation of Yahweh. Let us remember then that the aspect of the fire of the cherubic work of acceptance revealed in power through this divine manifestation. Fire in Ezekiel's representation is described as the fire enfolding itself. It was described as being bright. Fire is a figure that illustrates the power of God's hand. Brilliant, radiant activity, full of power, majestic and fearsome. And the fact that it enfolded itself demonstrates that the power was self-sufficient and self-sustaining. We think of the burning bush on Mount Horeb when we consider this power. Fire that came from deity in a second. In the second book of the second epistle of Thessalonians, it is revealed that Christ shall return to the earth to take vengeance upon its inhabitants. In what form? In flaming fire, taking vengeance upon those that know him not. However, fire in the scriptures speaks of two things. It is presented in fearsome consuming power in the case of judgment, but also has an aspect of purifying, to drive out the dross, to chastise through tried faith. What is the end of a man who comes through the fire? He will become an integral part of the power and essence of the cherubic glory, the cherubic object, capable and powerful of executing righteous and divine judgments on a wicked world. The word fire in Ezekiel is the word apilos, meaning unblemished and without spot. Are our characters, having been brought through the fire of tried faith, are they unblemished? Are we, brethren and sisters, without spot? In this figure of the cherubim glory, we must be manifested as such. A brother said to me when I first came into the truth 14 years ago, that the truth is not about a list of do's and don'ts. Should we have TV? Where's the specific scripture to say that I should or I shouldn't? Or should I have friends in the world? Where's the specific scripture to say that I should or shouldn't? The truth, brethren and sisters, is not like this at all, as we all know. The scriptures are full of revelations that are hidden. In this divine image of the cherubim, we are shown that we must possess the same characteristics of Christ and of the Christ body. Let this mind of Christ dwell in you, exhorts the apostle. Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your minds, we are exhorted. Brethren and sisters, this is a serious matter. We must be the Christ body now. Christ was the Logos. He was the mind of the Father in flesh, manifested upon the face of the earth. He said on several occasions, I and my Father are one. One we know in the sense of having the one mind and the same purpose, the same goal, the same process of thinking. Can we say, I or we and the Father are one. And now in the symbol, as we see it in Ezekiel, we move on to the four living creatures which emerge. The four living creatures that have faces and wings in perfect unity. These living ones speak of the limitless power of Christ and the saints in glory. They represent the saints in military action and civil administration, their movement at any given time determining which aspect. We see the living ones represented in the book of the Apocalypse, chapter 5, where they are presented here as a sea of glass. This sea of glass, as we well know, is indicative of the nations addressed. Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 24. Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 24 we read, "And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, as the noise of an host. When they stood, they let down their wings." Brethren and sisters, when they stand, they let down their wings of military action. First we have them in power and great glory pouring out divine judgment in the wrath of the great Almighty. And then this is succeeded by the peace of the nations, the glass of sea, or sea of glass rather. A glorious day is coming indeed. The future for us is easy to see. The wings show a revelation of the cherubim reaching to the throne, being elevated to the throne. On those who are able to reach into the throne, as we see in Revelation chapter 5, verse 6, the Father's name becomes inscribed upon their foreheads. Revelation 14, verse 1. "And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads." This carries us, brethren and sisters, right into the future. That number which shall constitute the final redeemed multitude, all-seeing and all-powerful. The whole cherubic manifestation was full of eyes. Eyes in the scripture illustrate a multitude. In Ezekiel 1, verse 18, we see the hosts of Yahweh. Here we have proof that the cherubim reveals a host of mighty ones. Revelation chapter 5 gives the multitudinous number as 10,000 times 10,000 and 1,000 times thousands, so we cannot begin to number them. This aspect of the multitudinous Christ is represented in the vision as clouds that came out of the whirlwind. Now, a whirlwind, as we know, is an intense wind of circular motion that causes devastating destruction. We know that the judgments of God are indeed characterized in this way. In Isaiah, God tells us that he is coming to shake terribly the earth, and so the usage of a hurricane or whirlwind is a fitting one in this context. Jeremiah 24 tells us that Yahweh hath a controversy with the nations. We know that the cloud speaks of the multitude of saints. Come with me to Isaiah 66, verse 14, which gives us an interesting illustration of this multitude. Isaiah 66, verse 14 to 16. "When ye see this, your heart shall rejoice, and your bones shall flourish like an herb, and the hand of Yahweh shall be known toward his servants, and his indignation toward his enemies. For behold, Yahweh will come with fire and with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword will Yahweh plead with all flesh, and the slain of Yahweh shall be many. So we see there at the back end of verse 14 that the hand of Yahweh shall be known toward his servants and also those to whom indignation will come. One thing is for sure, the destruction shall be many. There is an aspect to the cloud of brightness. Now we know that clouds are a formation of millions of water droplets drawn up from the sea. And as we've already said, we know that the sea in Scripture speaks of the nations. God is taking out of the nations, out of the Gentiles, a multitude, a people for his name. This is revealed here in divine manifestation, the people of the new heaven and the new earth. The time is at hand when that process is about to stop for this phase of the plan. We know that God will continue to redeem the inhabitants of the millennium and offer to them a gospel of hope. But the 6,000-year phase is drawing to an end, and soon we will see this cherubic vision manifest itself in glory. Brother Wayne in March said that the cherubim in a sentence was spirit manifested and corporealized in the saints, the one eternal spirit in divine manifestation. John says that he comes with clouds, a multitude of saints. Now another aspect of cloud is rain. Rain is a benevolent blessing of the righteous ale. As we saw that the cherubim with wings outstretched represented something different to when the wings were let down, so we see a different aspect of the cloud here portrayed. When the cloud goes forth in judgment upon the godless nations, God is manifest in a multitude as a consuming fire. On the other hand, when the cloud drops rain, which feeds the earth, we see the manifestation of benevolence, of the love and the goodness of God, divine judgment, then divine blessing. Verse 13 of Ezekiel 1. Verse 13 of Ezekiel 1. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps. It went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the earth went forth lightning. The wheels demonstrate activity. They demonstrate power and life. That which inspires us to action is surely the contemplation of immortality. The terrible crystal, Yah's power in his atonement. We know that Jesus himself took hold of the divinic covenant. Let us cast our minds back to Genesis 3, verse 24. The cherubim and flaming sword turned every way to keep the tree. The wheels, we are informed, turned not. Redemption, brethren and sisters, is redemption. Truth is truth, and it turns not. The first four faces turned not, they went straight forward. In preserving the truth, we must adopt the same approach. Buy the truth, we are told, are we not, and sell it not. What a responsibility we have in ensuring that we guard the truth and hold fast to it, turning not. It would be easier to lay our defenses down and allow brethren and sisters to do as they desired with the truth. That would be the easy position to take. That indeed is the way of the natural man, and it is the way that he always feels. But the commands of God propel us in a different direction. We are given information here that demonstrates to us that the truth is Yahweh's, and we must deal with it in a forward direction, not turning to the left or right hand, but keeping it in the power of preservation. The truth is not ours to do with it what we will, but as in the case of Cain and Abel, to do with it as Yahweh wills. Coming back then to the aspect of the wings, what were the wings doing, we may ask, that weren't covering the body? We know that they weren't used for propulsion because the wheels took care of that. They were stretched upwards, and we learn that they were joined one to another. If you look down from the throne, you would see a perfect circle in prayer, reaching forth through the crystal into the throne itself. This represents an acceptable community, those who offer grace to the world, hands protruding from under the wings offering the covenant of grace. Hands speak of work, they can accomplish much. We will remember in March, Brother Wayne, in his talk on the cherubim, given in March, said that hands that are trained can perform brain surgery, they can build skyscrapers, airplanes, ships, whatever it may be. But in this aspect of the cherubim, the useful and purposeful hands of the living ones are active in offering the covenant of grace. What a wonderful responsibility for us. What a wonderful hope that we have. There's only two sides to the cherubic glory, the cloud and the fire. Is Christ the hope of glory in you? We're all well familiar with 1 John 1 verses 5 and 7 that talks about God being the light. So let us go to Deuteronomy chapter 4 to consider where it says and where it talks about God in different manifestations, certainly here as a consuming fire. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 24 as we bring our remarks this morning to a close. Deuteronomy 4, verse 24. For Yahweh thy Elohim is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. When thou shalt beget children and children's children, and ye shall have remained long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves and make a graven image, or the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of Yahweh thy Elohim to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that ye shall soon utterly perish from off the land whereunto ye go over Jordan to possess it. Ye shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. And Yahweh shall scatter you among the nations, and ye shall be left few in number among the nations, whither Yahweh shall lead you. And there ye shall serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see, nor hear, nor eat, nor smell. These characteristics of the cherubic glory have to be blended into our lives. The prospect is wonderful. Isaiah 30 tells us that the name of Yahweh cometh from afar, burning with his anger. This is the future glory about to be manifested in the earth. These are great and important truths regarding our future. In the truth today, brethren and sisters, people are becoming more liberally minded. Things are done which would never have been contemplated by those in Brother Thomas's day. Our minds in society are conditioned. They are conditioned to be liberal, to accept diversity and to accept change. Let every man do that which is right in his own eyes. Because of this liberal way of thinking, our consciences to some degree become seared, and the activities which once horrified us are far more tolerable to us today. Everything we read that isn't on the truth, everything that is watched on TV, everything listened to on the radio, pop songs, music, whatever it may be, all serve to condition our mind, but only in one direction. The direction of that which is carnal. The carnal mind is at enmity with God. This conditioning of our minds not only propels us to do that which we shouldn't, but we've also stopped raising the issues which concern us when our brethren and sisters do those things which we may not agree with from the scriptures. It's nothing to do with me, they have to answer for what they do, has become the attitude of the day. Was that the Apostle Paul's attitude, brethren and sisters? Let every man do that which is right in his own eyes. Paul exhorts us against this way of thinking. He says in 1 Corinthians 11 verse 2, keep the ordinances, keep the traditions as I delivered them unto you. Paul's ordinance, his tradition, must always be kept before our minds. It was when the Judaizers came into the ecclesias that the traditions were turned right around and the traditions of the truth were destroyed by them. 324 AD, the complete destruction of the truth. Let Christ be our example. Let Christ be our example as we behold those divine characteristics of the divine Christ body in the cherubim. If brethren and sisters become our example for us to follow, then at best we'll only ever be as faithful as our fellow brother or sister. That may be okay, but the danger is that may be far short of where we all need to be. If we take Christ as our example, then we will always know we are falling far short and will continue to try harder each and every day, the transforming of our minds, like the wings of this figure stretching up to the throne, that great desire for immortality, the stretching up of the wings to the throne. Do we truly see, brethren and sisters, ourselves as a part of the cherubic manifestation? Are you and I the ones of this generation who shall be revealed in this type of majestic power and glory? Are our characters unblemished? Can our actions and our thoughts be described as without spot? Ezekiel's vision speaks of our feet being straight and like the sole of a calf's foot, upright and sure-footed, the colour of burnished brass. Brass was one of the cheapest in value of all of the metals, but brass is tough and hard-wearing. It speaks of steadfastness. Sure-footed, it knows what it's doing and where it's going in an upright walk. Let us ensure that during the day of our opportunity, we pour our thoughts over these visions. We will be taken out of the problems of the present and projected forth to the glories of the future, when Yahweh, the Almighty, shall be manifested in the characteristics and work of the cherubim. Our final quotation, Psalm 149. Psalm 149. Praise ye Yahweh. Sing unto Yahweh a new song and his praise in the congregation of saints. Let Israel rejoice in him that made him. Let the children of Zion be joyful in their king. Let them praise his name in the dance. Let them sing praises unto him with a timbrel and harp. For Yahweh taketh pleasure in his people. He will beautify the meek with salvation. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the nations and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honor have all his saints. Praise ye, Yahweh.